This is Authors in Focus.
Hi, I'm James Reed, fantasy author publishing under JMD Reed. And my newest fantasy series is going strong. Readers have enjoyed Diamond Stained, and now Obadon and Nabina return for their fifth and final story. Things have never been more dangerous. The entirety of the five-book Secret of the Jewel series is out on Amazon and free in Kindle Unlimited. Today, I'm joined by Chris Ludwig. He is the author of the sci-fi novel Systemic.
How are you doing today, Chris?
Doing just fine.
Awesome, awesome. Well, I always like to start things off with some fun questions. So, what is your favorite color?
It depends what I'm doing with the color. I think probably blue or green. If I just had to put a gun to my head, I chose two. So, let's go green.
All right. And in honor of what you're writing, what is your favorite AI Goes Evil and Kills Humanity movie?
AI Goes Evil and Kills Humanity movie. Well, so the thing I'm writing or have recently written is actually an AI Does Very Nice Things to People movie. So,
yeah, but those don't exist, so we have to go with the other option.
You know, it's funny now that I'm thinking about it. I don't know that I have a movie about AIs that freak out and kill everybody, but I love pretty much every episode of Black Mirror, which is kind of just technology run amok and killing people and doing things. There's some pretty dark episodes of that I love. Blade Runner, I mean, that's not really, it's AI running around trying to kill people. That's got to be a classic. That one's pretty high up there. And, you know, The Matrix is technically an AI that is running around killing humanity. And true. I totally love that one. And my daughter was annoyed at me for making her watch that. And I said, I thought it was a great movie. She's like, no, it was good, but it made me think things I didn't want to think.
Oh, that's pretty terrible.
Well, for a 12-year-old, I thought that was pretty. I was like, I think I've succeeded. So
I just thought you made her watch like The Matrix Reloaded.
And no, I love my daughter.
All right, so let's talk about your book. Okay. In the future, an AI has solved all our problems. There are three individuals on a journey to find the truth. Why don't you tell us about these three individuals and what motivates them?
All right. Well, first off, not what they think, so there's that, what motivates them. But there's three individuals, and this movie, or the movie, now you're going to be talking about movies. The book starts off with Mike, who has, he's woken up one morning, and he finds out that the woman that he loves is about to be paired up with somebody across the country. And she says, hey, you know, get here quick before I wind up being paired to somebody. And of course, she doesn't know who, because the way that the system works, it has solved all of our problems. Dating, of course, being a problem, it solved that one, and it basically matches you up and makes a match for you. So she's going to be paired up, and she would like him to be part of the consideration set, because there's going to be, you know, four people and she gets to choose or whatever. And so he's got to get out to Prower, where she lives, before she's paired up. So that's Mike. He's a lovesick young man, and he wants to go find this woman who he loves. There is a woman named Erin, and Erin is actually from Prower. It's this small town in the middle of the high desert, and she is going home. She hasn't been there in many, many years, and she wants to return home and see her mother. They are demolishing her old house, and so she would like to go and visit home before her house is destroyed and she can never visit it again. And that's Erin. And then there is Lem. Lem is my favorite disaster. He's likes to make extremely bad decisions, and he's made quite a few. And because this AI is in charge of pretty much everything that happens in life, he's down on his luck. He's made some poor choices with regards to his wife and offspring, and so he's decided that this AI is to blame for all of his pain and suffering. And so he's headed out to Prower, where it is hosted, to bring it to an end. And those are their motivations: revenge, love, and return home.
Well, I have to say, I'm already on board with the guy that wants to destroy an all-controlling AI.
Yeah, it's an easy one. Yeah, you got to get the AI. It's oppressive and terrible. It's fun, actually. He's got an AI who's a sub-AI of the system who kind of works as kind of the angel and the devil on his shoulders. It's always kind of whispering ideas into his head. And so he actually has I guess you would say his best friend is also an AI, and he's out to destroy all the AIs. And so there's a little bit of interesting tension going on there between him and the big AI, due to the fact that he has a little AI on his shoulder. So
it kind of reminds me a bit of Olympus and Ilium by Dan Simmons. You ever read those?
I have not.
Okay. Well, it's a crazy series. But one of the things in there is that there's like this population of there's a very small population of humans left on Earth that are managed by an AI.
Mm-hmm. That sounds.
And yeah, they can basically, you know, do whatever they want, and the AI will like keep them healthy, and they can travel the world. And but one of the plot points is that the AI is malfunctioning, and it can keep track of less and less people. So it has a very simple solution to that issue. So.
I have an upward bounds of the number of people, and so anybody above me, I'm gonna.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And partly it's because they use quantum teleportation, which is, of course, you just get destroyed on one end, reassembled on the other end, and it's supposed to keep track of all your thoughts and personality and all that. So that's its issue, like you know. But it also has other problems. It thinks it's from Shakespeare's Tempest. You know, it's the demon from there. So it has some issues.
Yeah.
Dan Simmons likes to get very literary with this series.
No, I should read that. You know, I
there's a whole subsection about the Greek gods recreating the Trojan War on Mars in that series.
What's it called?
It's called Olympus and Ilium, and it's kind of like a sci-fi retelling of those stories, complete with an Odysseus wandering around, you know, trying to get back home, and like, wow, and it is insane.
Yeah, it's funny when I wrote this book, and the thing that I'm surprised about is people coming out and saying, you know, that reminds me a lot of this thing and that, and it's like, okay, that's great. And some things I've read or watched since I made the book, it's like, oh yeah, I could definitely see how you would draw that conclusion. It's pretty spot on. And it kind of makes you, you know, there's nothing new under the sun in a way, and the 100 monkeys typing and all that stuff. But I've been pointed at some things that I'm like, oh, there's definitely some common DNA between what I wrote and that, including I didn't even know about this one whole series, the Culture series. By is it Ian M. Banks, I think, is who wrote it, and it is very, very similar in concept. Those are kind of
I've heard it, but
it's the same kind of the culture being this giant computer that, yeah, this thing's pretty well figured out, and you know, it's, but some people are kind of not real happy about it. It's like, oh yeah, I can see that. My friend turned me onto that one. I've been reading those since I wrote the book. So.
Yeah, Dan Simmons' other major popular series, the Hyperion Cantos.
Oh, he wrote Hyperion.
Yeah, he wrote the Hyperion Cantos.
Oh, okay. Yeah, so I wrote Hyperion. That's great.
Yeah, so same guy did that. So you understand the sort of crazy literary blending in sci-fi he does.
Yeah, absolutely. I liked Hyperion. Hyperion's one of those funny books that I saw it when I was in high school. And I never read it. My buddy Abe turned me on to sci-fi in high school, and that was one book that he always had, was Hyperion. And I love the picture on it. You know, it's got the Shrike
standing
up there, and it's got the big plane with the boat, like the ship sailing through the grain. And I'm like, it was just such an intriguing picture. And about, I don't know, 2 or 3 years ago, I was like, you know, I still remember the name of that book, and I still remember the picture. And so I listened to most of my books, and it was great. I loved it. And yeah, so I've got the other ones on the Cantos in my on my wish list, but I haven't quite gotten to them yet. But
okay, yeah, there's some interesting AIs about how the AI get their processing power in that universe. That was really intriguing. So I found it kind of haunting reading your blurb about how there was like they're moving through like lonely sage lands and underpopulated cities, and it kind of gives the impression that like this AI has kind of turned the world into like a zoo, you know, it's controlling everything, and it's keeping everything at low levels, right, so it can manage things. Is that correct? That's the impression I got.
Yeah, I mean, it's not entirely inaccurate. The thing that everybody wants the AIs to be the bad guy, which I get, right? And so one of the things is the AI really is not the bad guy. What it does is it solves the problems that humans ask it to solve. Right. So one of the things and the reason that everything's so underpopulated was there was too many people. And so they said, you know, we got to figure out this problem. And it said, OK, I've got some solutions to that. And, you know, we're not going to kill people. We're not going to do anything mean like that. But what we have done is he or it came up with these policies, some of which work, some of them didn't. It iterates on policies over time. And where they landed was, we're just going to give everyone birth control. And when you don't want kids, that's fine. Like, you can always have kids. We'll just, you know, take away your birth control when it's time to have it. But turns out a lot of kids are unexpected. And so the number of people who are going to go bother to get unbirth controlled is pretty low. And so that was it. It's just birth became an opt-in rather than an opt-out sort of proposition. And it really cut down the population pretty significantly. And that's what it is. But the thing about the zoo isn't entirely inaccurate. It's not the AI's intention, but it's more the real thrust behind the book is that over time we offloaded more and more and more of our concerns onto this AI that just solves problems for us, and we stopped having problems to solve, and our population lost, you know, we lost our population, and it makes all of our art for us, and it makes all of our music for us, and at the end of the day, what do you have? And it's not really the bad guy in the story, if there is one, isn't the AI, but the people who had the AI solve all the problems that probably people should have been solving the whole time. It's not maliciousness on the AI's part.
But I gotcha.
It does make for a haunting sort of empty retraction in contraction, I should say, of humanity outside of all the population centers and such. So yeah.
I mean, yeah, it's the ultimate order, right? I mean, that's kind of like, you know, the mankind exists in the dichotomy between wanting order but living in a chaotic world. And what we desire, nothing more, is at least the illusion that everything is orderly and that it's under our control. And so I can see the appeal of just saying, like, we found this way to make sure it's all under our control because our super smart programmers came up with this AI. See, this is why I'm not like the AI will be evil. It's just that people programmed it. Therefore, the AI is going to be programmed by, you know, people who are probably like incompetent in some way, or they missed a line of code, or
yeah. And that's kind of the point. Like, I'm really interested in people more than anything else. And then the AI is like, it's just a mirror of us, right? So it does what we want it to, and nothing more and nothing less. And it's actually one of the core tenets of this thing is that it can't hurt people. It's programmed not to, which, you know, laws of robotics and all those sorts of things. And so, you know, the problem isn't the AI. The problem is us and the things that we had it solve and what's left for us after it solved everything for us. But yeah, it's now everything's under control, and it's really at the end of the day boring. Really at the end of the day, it's ennui and boredom that's driving people to their own suffering at that point.
Okay. So do you think a global AI could ever exist and be like a force for good?
Well, I think it's possible. It can also, you know, it's like anything else. An AI is a tool, and you can, the more powerful your tools are, the better they are, and the more dangerous they are. And that's just, that dichotomy is going to exist in any situation. And so, to your point, it depends who programs it, why they program it, what data they feed into it, what are the inherent problems with the data they feed into it. I mean, we see these things happening today. And so to the extent that those things can be corrected, yeah, it could be a great force for good. There's a lot of stuff people aren't real good at doing. And the problem, the hard part becomes, where do you draw that line, and who gets to decide? Right. So if you have one guy who runs a large company, and he knows if he can get an AI to solve this problem, he'll make a lot of money. But it's not the sort of problem that society generally would want an AI to solve. For instance, making music. I can make music that will sell very well through an AI. But if we take away all the the musical expression or the writing and the art creation from people, you personally, sir, can make a lot of money doing that. But what happens to us as humanity who aren't able to express ourselves in any way? We actually lose the skill set to express ourselves in ways that are meaningful to us and elevate us as a culture. So yeah, I think it could. It could also be bad. It could be good. Again, I think it depends on who's in control of it and what their objectives are and what they feed into it. But get rid of traffic. Like, no one wants to solve the traffic problem. Like, let the AIs figure out that crap. And a global AI that makes all the airplanes and boats and cars more efficient and syncs them all up so they work well together, that sounds pretty sweet. Like, I would love that. There's a global AI. Something good for you.
Maybe. Well, I don't know. They've. I mean, there's issues with self-driving cars. Sensor malfunctions. They don't work well in poor atmospheric conditions. Mm-hmm. I mean, all those things are real problems.
Yeah.
There might not be an ultimate solution to actually achieve it in a dynamic, ever-changing environment.
Mm-hmm.
Like the road system.
Yeah, humans suck at driving too.
Humans do suck at driving, but if humans are paying attention when they're driving, they can actually cope with all that. It's when humans are not paying attention, that's the issue.
Yeah, which
you can get the same, you'll get the same issues with the self-driving cars, which is why you're not supposed. It's why when you have a self-driving car, you're supposed to actually be paying attention to what it's doing. So you're there to back it up if it malfunctions or it misinterprets what it sees. I mean, that's how that guy got killed, because he was just like watching Harry Potter and his self-driving car drove right into the back of one of the big rigs, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was like stopped and the sensors just didn't detect it.
Yeah.
And he went right into it at 60 miles per hour.
Yeah, that'll kill you no matter who's driving.
But if he wasn't watching the Harry Potter movie, he probably would have seen the big rig coming up at him.
No, it's definitely true. Like there's problems with these things and nothing. I think that it says a lot potentially about our expectations of AI that, you know, we expect it to be able to do things that are, you know, so much better than humans. I think that's interesting. It's like, oh, well,
it is. Yeah. Cause there's like our brains are very good at certain things. And one of them is sort of spatial, like calculations of trajectory and velocities and stuff like that. We do it innately without even, like, when you throw a ball to try to get into a hoop, you're making really complicated math equations without even knowing it, you know, stuff that, you know, because you're calibrating the force of the throw, the angle, the, you know, all that stuff, all these variables. And so it's rather impressive. Like, if you do the math on that, it's a rather complicated formula that.
Oh, yeah.
So there's definitely things that. So it's kind of like where humans aren't good at pattern, you know, at like good data, like sifting through so much data that it's impossible for any human. That's, you know, so like traffic, you know, not traffic like cars, but like signal traffic and, you know, looking at trends in markets and stuff like that for like, because they use AIs in trading on the stock market these days. And so, yeah, it's just knowing where to use your AI smartly and where to rely on what the human brain does very well. You know,
yeah, and
that we struggle to have computers, you know, do.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that, and I'm no expert in quantum computing and things, but I have a feeling that a lot of some of the things that humans do very well are going to be things that quantum computers do. Like quantum computers could basically mimic, in theory, like they mimic intuition, for example, like things that humans where we'll like jump 30 things ahead and solve some problem that we know is coming. Like that's kind of quantum computers are going to be able to do some stuff like that. It'll be kind of weird. I am not a quantum computer technician or anything like that, or even a theorist, but I understand a little bit about what they can do. And I would imagine that the world of 20 years from now with quantum computing will be as bizarre to us as the world of cell phones are to my grandma. You know, it's going to be that weird, and I just don't even know how. And so I don't know what computers will be good at. I know what they suck at now.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, so it's like
they do seem to think if you get like if you build a computer, a quantum computer like the size of the Earth, I think you can simulate the entire universe.
Mm-hmm.
Is what the theory is. Yeah, where do you fall on that, by the way, on simulation theory? Are we in a computer?
You know, it's funny. My friend Titus, he likes to argue with me about this, and I have the worst answer in the world, and it drives him crazy. My answer is, who cares? or it doesn't matter. And he's like, what do you mean it doesn't matter? Of course it matters. And I'm like, no, man, think about it. If we're in a game, let's just call it a game, even though it doesn't.
Historical simulation is what people would say. Yeah. Because of
whatever. But yeah, you can call it whatever you want. It's a simulated world. The rules are the rules of the rules. Like, you know, that's how it's set up. And your feeling of pain, if it's programmed or if it's organic, it doesn't particularly matter. It's still painful, and you still do the things that you do to avoid them. And when your simulation is up, you either go to another simulation or you go to heaven or you don't do anything and it doesn't change. I just have a feeling that when you really get down to it, the methods that were used to create and derive our experience in our universe very well may be simulated, or they're not. And it doesn't practically change anything. It answers some interesting questions, but I don't know. So I am, and part of me would be fascinated to find out that we were in a simulation. But I think that if I found out, if somebody came and definitively to me yesterday said, do you know that you live your entire life within a simulation? I would say, well, that explains Donald Trump. And that's about it. Yeah, okay. I'm like, yeah, I can cope with that. I can deal with it. And it doesn't really change my opinion about things too much. But yeah, that's my answer. Do I think it's likely? I think that mathematically it's likely. Do I think that, you know, my intuition, is it true? Nah, I don't think it's true. But again, I wouldn't cry either way to find out. What's your opinion?
Well, Donald Trump is easy. He's a reaction to the corruption that we all see in our political system.
Mm-hmm.
It's the same thing that drove the Occupy Wall Street movement in the very beginning before it got co-opted.
Yeah.
It's the same reason that drives people out into the streets to riot, even though they don't know why they're angry. But we all can feel that there's something broken about our system, and Donald Trump is one of those symptoms.
Yeah,
because he tapped into that same anger, you know.
Yeah, I think there's this part of me that if I play around with the simulation theory, you ever play like any of those sim worlds, and you're like, I'm just going to blow up a city and see what happens. It's like, there's part of me that's like, oh, that's what's going on there with all of that stuff. You're right. It's just like, where's all this chaos coming from? And it's like, well, you know, maybe it's some parameter, maybe it's something that people are tweaking. I don't know.
Well, I can't remember what it's called, but there's a property in mathematics where the more you have, the more you get. So like 1% of all stars are giant stars, but they hold, you know, 90% of all the mass in the universe, but they're 1% of all the stars, but they're 90% of all their mass. Same thing with cities. Like, you know, New York City is a giant city for a reason, because it has a lot, and therefore it draws in more, which makes it grow bigger, which makes it draw in more. So they feed on each other. Same thing happens with money, with, sure. So that's why you get more and more wealthy people, and that creates the have-nots, and that creates an angry underswell, and then it erupts into chaos, and you have an upheaval of the system, and then it will all settle out for a while, and then the accumulation of wealth into specific spots will begin again. And that's it's just a principle of mathematics. And we're reaching one of those points right now, that's all.
Yeah, when you say not disagreeing with you at all, but when you start saying, well, the reality is structured the way that it is because of a principle of mathematics, then you start to say, well, wait a second, that's interesting. Well, it's interesting that principles of mathematics seem to be driving everything around us, and that's like, you know, that's one check on the column for it's all a simulation, right? Or
mathematics explains the universe. It's mathematics is underlies everything in the universe.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, but then you got to say why.
Yeah, but it's just like, it's the same reason that, like, you know, 1% of all the stars have most of the mass. 1% of all the people have most of the money. You know, 1% of all the cities have most of the population. All the same thing.
Yeah.
Just but with human civilization, there's a way to change that, and it's through civil strife and, you know, bloody conflict, sadly.
Yeah.
We have yet to find a way to not have it end that way.
Yeah, maybe it's maybe mathematical. Maybe there's something specific about human nature and evolutionary biology that makes that happen too. You know, it'd be interesting to know, like, you know, I spent a lot of time, like, you know, in philosophy classes and stuff in college, like, you know, kind of theorizing about these things. And maybe, like I said, maybe it's evolutionary biology. Maybe it's mathematics. Maybe it's inevitable. It's like, it would be nice to have somebody come by and say, oh, no, it's inevitable. Or no. You guys assumed it was inevitable because that's the way you were behaving and it had a feedback loop. Like, it would be nice to know, you know, why things turned out the way that they do, why they turn out and tend to turn out the way that they do. It would be cool to know. And maybe the way we would find that out is if somebody said, nope, this is in fact a simulation. Have you read Neal Stephenson's Fall?
No, I mean, I honestly am not really a sci-fi fan. I read more fantasy. I've never read any of Neal Stephenson's stuff, so sorry.
Yeah, well, no, it's fine. I read it, and between you and me, I didn't particularly enjoy the book, but there were some fun ideas in it about simulation theory that were pertinent to the discussion, but... So if you don't like sci-fi, are you like into fantasy? Like, what is it that you're into?
I'm into fantasy.
Yeah.
Science fiction is too grounded in reality for me.
Fair enough.
And if it's not, then it's like Star Wars, and it's really like sci-fantasy.
Yeah. Somebody asked me if, like, the other day I was being interviewed, and they asked me about Star Wars and sci-fi. And I was like, well, if you want to be technical about it, so Star Wars is not particularly sci-fi.
No, yeah. It's a fantasy story with a sci-fi veneer.
Yeah, it's where it took place, right? Yeah. It's like it took place in the sci-fi. Man. No, I sci-fi for me, and like I read a fair amount of fantasy, not high fantasy so much, but lots of things that are I read a lot of speculative fiction just generally is kind of what I do. But my book, I didn't even know that it was sci-fi for about the first 90 pages I was writing it. I had something I was going for. And it could have gone a lot of different ways. And then what happened to me was I was trying to think of one of the things that bothers me a lot is this sort of destruction of truth that is going on in the world and just totally tearing that down. And just institutions that traditionally have been something that we rely on, and they're just going away for various reasons that, you know, are interesting or not interesting to get into, but it bothers me at any rate. And I was trying to think, how do we ever get ourselves out of this? At what point do we go, never mind, we were wrong, and science is right, and you know, the media can be trusted again, or whatever. Like, how do you get this yourself out of a world where everybody doesn't trust anybody else, and institutions aren't trusted, and people would rather believe these crazy things or whatever. And so
it's rather simple. You have a civilization collapse, and then a new civilization starts up, and it goes civilizations follow a very predictable path. Once we're in the decadence, going into the decay part, like, you know, where we, you know, like the generations that build an empire, you know, they're the, you know, they build something, but the following generations have less and less appreciation for it, and they let it all fall apart, and then it collapses, and someone new comes along and starts it up again.
Well,
so yep. we're in the decadence phase, which is right before the collapse phase.
Yeah, I mean that life cycle of empire and mm-hmm. civilization. Sure. That said, I'm not looking forward to the collapse of my. You know, the empire we live in. And so I was thinking about that, and that's how the sci-fi book was that.
I understand. It sucks. And, yeah. And I don't see us doing much to stop it.
Yeah.
So
I wrote a book. That's what I did. I was like, well, to your point, like, you can't argue with people on Facebook about it, and you can't do this and that and the other thing. And so, you know, the way I handled my discomfort with all of that was to write a story about it, and that's how it became a sci-fi book. My point is definitely, like, I didn't intend to write a sci-fi book necessarily when I set out. It could have been a lot of different types of book. It just turned out to be one because it had to be one.
Okay. Well, so what is next for you in your writing career?
Well, I just wrote a short story, and I'm going to try to get that published. And I'm working on the sequel to Systemic. I've got it might be two books, it might be one. I'm not quite sure. I'm about 200 to 300 pages into it. And so I'm either 300 pages into one book, or I'm 150 pages into two different books, and I'll know in a little while, but I'm developing that, and it's kind of after my book is over, and you'll love it. I shouldn't give this away, but it probably won't hurt anybody. The civilization that the system is holding up does collapse right towards the end of the book is what they how the book ends, and so it picks up where that leaves off. I like to say Systemic is a pre-apocalyptic book, and after that is the wandering around trying to make sense out of everything that happened in the first book and how we recover from that, if we recover from that at all. So that's what I'm working on right now.
All right, cool. So why don't you let our listeners know where they can find you on the internet?
Oh, sure. So you can find me on Facebook. It's Chris Lodwig, author. You can get me on Amazon if you wanted to buy the book. It's Amazon. It's called Systemic. And my last name is Lodwig, L-O-D-W-I-G. And you can also get the book on Audible, iTunes. And I also have an Instagram page. You can look up Chris Lodwig. There's like two Chris Lodwigs in the whole world. So if you look me up, you'll find me or some fourth grade teacher in Pennsylvania. I'm not the fourth grade teacher in Pennsylvania. I'm the one who works at Microsoft. So.
Yeah, I noticed that your area code is just next county over for me.
Yeah, you're down in Tacoma, right?
Yeah.
I live down. I didn't live in Tacoma when I was a kid. I lived in Spanaway.
That's actually where I'm at, in Spanaway.
Oh, you're in Spanaway. Yeah, I was.
Yeah, I just moved out here from Parkland.
Okay.
But yeah. I grew up in South Hill, actually.
I don't know Tacoma too well, but when I moved to Spanaway when I was like in kindergarten, and I lived there through third grade, and then I moved all around the world and such. But I was down at Sprinker just not too long ago, before all this happened. My girl had a volleyball tournament down there, so I was like, oh, it's Sprinker. I don't know if you know where Sprinker is, but it's that big.
Oh, yeah, no, I went there when I was a kid, yeah.
Yeah, I used to play soccer there when I was a little tyke and take, you know, gymnastics classes down at Sprinker.
Yeah. So. Well, it was great chatting with you, Chris.
Yeah, it was great talking to you. So, yeah.
You have a good one, man.
Yeah, take care. I appreciate you talking.
Yep.
Bye-bye.
This has been Authors in Focus. You can find my fantasy novels on Amazon. Follow news of my writing at my blog, jmd-read.com. And follow me on Twitter, at jmdread. You can also join my reader group on Facebook, Fantastical Worlds of the Imagination. You can find more episodes of the podcast at fantasy-focus.com and wherever your favorite podcast is hosted.